Okay, so welcome to this session. I guess it's always a bit of a challenge getting people back on last afternoon, directly after lunch, particularly when it's such a gorgeous day, but I think we'll get started. We're sort of moving back to the bigger picture now, and that's sustained access to antiretrovirals. It gives me great pleasure to welcome the moderator for this session, Dr. Meg Doherty, who has stood in relatively last minute. She's coordinator of HIV treatment and care at the World Health Organization has got a very interesting hour lined up. So I'll hand over to you, Meg. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. And I hope more people come in. And if not, then we'll have a very lively conversation among those of you who are here and left over and interested in how do we get there, sort of the reality check. And I know Gottfried would be very happy to be here, but he unfortunately was unable to make it. So sorry that we have some stand-ins. And this afternoon, we are going to have a very nice panel talking about getting to universal ART access and how do we do that? What are the innovations and what are our frameworks to getting there? Something at WHO that we've called Treatment 2.0. So just as a brief background, WHO reported in this past year, and you're probably well aware of this, that 9.7 million are already on ART at the end of 2012. And in 2012, 1.6 million were put on in just that one short period, more than in any other year. However, there's a broad difference among countries who are reaching universal access or already there, and those that are falling behind or and having a widening gap between those who need it and those who are getting on therapy or those countries that are stable. So how has WHO and the other UN agencies dealt with this? We've created what we call a strategic use of ARVs for treatment and prevention agenda. Some of you may know this is called SUFA. And one of the main products that we had this year in 2013 was our consolidated ARV guidelines for both treatment and for prevention. And as you know, we've raised the threshold to 500, and we've increased the number of CD4 irrespective categories for initiating ART, and you've probably heard about some of them today, including serodiscordant couples, pregnant women, and children under 5 years. So we hope with all of this that we're giving more opportunities to put even more people on therapy. And our eligible pool, just with the 2013 guidelines, can go up to nearly 17 million. And we hope that this will get us to the 15 million by 2015. And in some ways, we may be even looking at longer-term targets. And as we've heard from UNAIDS, trying to eliminate or reduce AIDS or the end of AIDS by 2030. But how are we going to do this? And I think that that's what our framework has helped us to look into. What are the testing approaches, diagnostic approaches, and now service delivery approaches that will bring ARVs closer to home? And we're going to have a panel on this afternoon and presentations to really discuss the realities and the challenges and the opportunities in this approach. So it's my pleasure to introduce Marco Vittoria, who's the medical officer for treatment and care in the HIV department at WHO. He's been working there for 10 years as the expert on treatment 2.0 and will give us an update on innovations in treatment 2.0. And after that, we'll go into a more detailed discussions with our panelists.
Okay, thank you, Meg, and thanks for the organizers to invite for this interesting panel. Basically, if we make a kind of sum of everything that has been discussed during these 2 days, we are always talking about how can we really promote a more scalable, more efficient treatment models, and how can we innovate in this sense. And basically, you can say that we need simple drugs. We need better or simplified diagnostics, and we have talked a lot about point-of-care technologies, a kind of a next step in many ways in the lab diagnostics. And also, how can you move from health systems to community, trying to really bring some models for testing and care that involve more community? All these issues are very simple to say, but of course very complicated to do, as you have discussed here in almost these 2 days. And my objective here is try to give a perspective from WHO in a specific framework that we try to develop in these areas. Treatment 2.0 is an initiative developed by UNAIDS and WHO since 2010. Many of the people in this room already have participated in this meeting in New York, when we try to really prepare a kind of framework, try to really move towards more efficient gains in terms of treatment scale-up. This strategy, in fact, if you see the document, this document in blue that's already on the website, clearly states the overall framework for global approach on this sense. And basically, important to remember that not only in terms of optimized treatment, but also how to promote gains in terms of prevention. Then all discussions around treatment as prevention is already incorporated in this discussion there. There's not a new issue there. Then it's important to understand that this framework probably is a good technical framework to help us to think more about how to promote the use of antiretrovirus, not only for treatment of who is already sick, but also how to promote more strategic use of antiretrovirus to promote reduction in terms of new infections too. And this framework basically is composed by five major areas of action. The first one is about optimization of the regimens or the drugs that are being used. The second is about the optimization of the lab diagnostics. The third is how to really address the costing issues involving the treatment. The fourth is how to adapt the service deliveries and how to really promote better models. And the fifth, but not less important, is around the how to involve or mobilize communities. All these five pillars have specific activities that has been developed in WHO and with partners and also incorporated in many documents, including the guidelines that we released recently. In terms of drugs, this slide is just to show you some potential strategies to optimize it. Let's start with the low-hanging fruit of the story. One issue that has been used to improve the drugs is really to improve the root synthesis of the major components of the drugs. And it has been used in many ways to not only to simplify the production, but also to reduce the cost of production. Good example that you have is recently is tenofovir and efavirenz have suffered a lot of change in their process of manufacturing, and it has cutting some steps, using different routes of synthesis, and can permit people really reduce the cost and simplify the production. That can even simplify even the process to make licensing for other places. Then is an interesting approach that's not very visible, but important in terms of optimization. Of course, important to remember that reduction of the cost not necessarily or immediately implies in reduction of the price. That involve other issues that should be discussed. Dose reductions are another area that has been developed in many ways, and there are some studies showing that maybe you can use many of the antiretrovirals that are being applied in the field in those that are lower than they usually approve it, and probably reducing the toxicity and maintain the efficacy. There are a lot of trials in this area, and this is an issue that we also have been promoted in many meetings in WHO, how to really address it properly. It also involved the use of prodrugs of some antiretroviral that you already know, and it certainly is a strategy to evolve in the future and be important in the total framework of treatment optimization. Another important area that has been emphasized since 2010, but now in particular 2013, has been really flagged in the new guidelines, is the use of fixed dose combinations. Is it combine the drugs in a way that we can simplify not only for patients but for programs. It also can have impact in the price. There are other areas that's important to comment about the substitution for new drugs. Definitely is an area that we start to discuss with new classes coming. The use of new strategies, that's also interesting to discuss ways to really use the antiretrovirus in a more strategic or smart way. Example, induction maintenance with different drugs. And some issues that are coming now, improving drug bioavailability and using the extended release formulation or even nanotechnology, that are a little more in the future, but certainly can have impact in terms of the way that you use antiretrovirus in the following years. This slide is just to show you what has been developed by WHO and partners in terms of the strategies to optimize drugs. You have some meetings in Geneva and outside Geneva in the last 2 years and try really to see what would be the perspectives in terms of antiretroviral optimization short-term, medium-term, and long-term. In short-term, the consensus was around the improvement of the current available drugs and also formulations. And it was already incorporated in the recent guidelines, the use of the once-a-daily fixed-dose combination in first line, and we are now promoting tenofovir, TTC, efavirenz as the preferred approach for treatment in adults. The heat stable once daily boosted PIs, you need to go beyond lopinavir, ritonavir, and also bring other options like atazanavir and darunavir as a fixed dose combination with ritonavir. And also to promote use of solid pediatric formulations instead liquids in order to really improve the formulary for kids, particularly use the sprinkles and some dispersible tablets has been developed by some manufacturers. But in the middle term, until the next 5 years, probably you are expecting some replacement of some components of the regimens, like the use of new classes like integrase inhibitors or even some other prodrugs, entry blockers, issue that has been discussed in the recent meetings, and probably you need to see, in fact, how to do it, what's the best approach, what's the best niche for these drugs. And in long term, thinking more ahead, basically new strategies, as basically trying to new therapeutic approaches like induction maintenance, as I come before, core therapies, or even go into anti-latency drugs. That's part already the acute agenda that's been developed by some researchers. The more focusing a little more about the pipeline of products that you have around the drug optimization, this is the summary of a recent meeting held in South Africa, showing what are the drugs or the products that are around the corner that you need to start to think, not for this guideline, for the next one. One is really see if we can really improve the delivery of tenofovir. There are some recent prodrugs like the TAF one. You also have a CMX-157 that's a long-acting molecule that can be released with weeks or even months. We also have some potential superior beta-tolerated options for efavirenz in first line has been discussed, or even better sequencing to second line, like dolutegravir, and some new long-acting drugs like GSK744, and even the darunavir heat stable as a fixed-dose combination. These are all products that probably will be under discussion in the next guidelines revision, but basically it's to decide how to use it properly, what's the best niche, and how really it can be incorporated in policy countries. In terms of drugs, in summary, I think this is probably the best way to see the impact expected of different strategies that I commented before. In short term, definitely the issue about chemistry process and fixed dose combinations have a huge impact and probably exert a lot of impact in the next guidelines. The medium term, you can imagine that the dose reductions and new formulations, probably you really can bring an innovative approach in terms of these regimens. And in more in long term, you can think more about the new drugs and new strategies that can really put the treatment more easy for patients and for programs. And all this discussion have, in fact, impacted a lot in the guidelines. If you see what they're doing in terms of the evolution of the guidelines, really promoting early initiation, simpler therapy in terms of first line, less tox options, and also better monitoring, definitely are all treatment 2.0 strategy that has been incorporated in the new guidelines. However, drugs is not the only piece of the story. Basically, if you have a magic bullet, as many people talk about, it will not be enough in order to really put people in universal access or even move to the end of the epidemic, as commented by Meg. Basically, you have other challenges, and in terms of treatment 2.0 innovative approaches, you need also to continue to expand testing and better linkage to care. And WHO makes some recommendations in the last guidelines, try really to promote more the use of community-based testing, not only for general populations, but also in key populations, particularly in concentrated epidemics, and also start to discuss how can you address, for example, adolescents in terms of testing counseling. And then, of course, the next issue to be discussed is about the self-testing story that will be commented by the panelists today. That can be the future in terms of innovation. Let's see how can we really promote it in a proper way. What are the opportunities and challenges, what are the caveats that should be considered in order to really move beyond the testing in the conventional way, trying to really move towards self-testing. In terms of lab monitoring, there's a clear trend in order to move viral load as routine monitoring CD4 when needed, basically reversing the order that had been used in the last years, around promoting viral load as the best way or best approach to monitor response to treatment. And WHO now is discussing the point of care as an interesting platform to compose the matrix of diagnostics. And of course, there are a lot of issues to discuss around this, and Rosanna probably will make a lot of comments on how this should be incorporated in the matrix. How really can we see point of care, not to replace everything, but basically how to compose the current approach and how to contextualize the use of point of care technologies in different realities and really, what are the limitations of this technology, what are the things that we've done in order to implement as a policy. Equally important is the task shifting discussion. The task shifting is becoming an important recommendation in the 2013 guidelines. You have a lot of evidence from systematic reviews and studies showing clearly that nurses and physician clinicians can provide treatment and care in a very good way. And you really have promoted specific recommendations in order to permit the trained, well-trained non-physicians, clinicians, midwives, and nurses can initiate first line and maintain therapy, and also trained and supervised community health care workers can dispense antiretrovirals between clinic visits as a way to really try to simplify the approach and promote better access to treatment, moving towards a community approach. Decentralization is also an issue that is very linked to this. WHO has published specific recommendations in this sense, trying really to promote the initiation and maintenance of antiretroviral therapy at peripheral facilities, particularly trying to really move more quickly to this area. And initiation in periphery facilities and maintenance at community level between clinic visits. Trying really to incorporate this concept of decentralization, very linked to task shifting. And also important to talk about the service integration. That is a very important topic, because the word integration sometimes have different meanings in different cultures. Then you need to see how really to do it in a proper way. There are a lot of discussions in how this can be done in different contexts. But basically, WHO is really trying to promote that the initiation treatment of antiretroviral therapy can be initiated in TB, in MCH, in AOST settings, with some evidence from the literature and studies showing that clearly it can be better in terms to improve access to treatment. Adherence support is also a very important topic, and WHO have a lot of recommendations around how to do it more properly, trying to really move this area that is very, very, very complex, very complicated, but basically trying to use fixed dose combinations, strengthen the supply, peer support, and even mobile phone text messaging approach. There are a lot of issues that have been discussed that have been part of the discussions involving community too. And moving a little more ahead of the story, I think it's important to see how the issues around early treatment can be also important, not only for treatment who are already sick, but also not only about prevention too, but in terms of the agenda for HIVQ that has been developed recently. As you can see in this slide, early initiation of antiretroviral therapy is part of the spectrum of actions related to strategies to promote HIV cure. Then another way to see the issue of initiation is that we have people more prepared for the future strategies that have been developed, probably paving the way for better response to therapies that will be tested in the near future. And definitely, I think we need to start to think in how the research agendas in treatment optimization and in HIV can be linked, as probably both things will be part of the same piece of the story. Okay, thank you very much, and I'd like now to move to Meg in order to introduce the panelists.
Okay. Thank you, Marco. And for this panel discussion and session, we've decided to have very brief presentations from each of our panelists who really represent some of the work that they're doing in the field and the real-life examples. So we have Peter McPherson, who's from the Liver School, School of Tropical Medicine, as well as Rosanna Peeling from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and Roger Tech from Médecins Sans Frontières. Each of them has a specific expertise in a part of the innovations of treatment 2.0. So it's my pleasure to introduce Peter McPherson, who's a public health physician and PhD student at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, and he recently completed a cluster randomized trial in Blantyre, Malawi, investigating home-based initiation of ART following self-testing. So he'll be talking about the innovation piece about increasing access through testing and self-testing and community-based testing approaches. So we have about 5 minutes, and then we'll move on to the next presenter. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Meg. So despite mounting evidence that the high rates of HIV testing followed by timely and complete initiation of ART could really make a substantial contribution to HIV prevention as well as care, uptake of HIV testing rates remain disappointingly low. In the countries of sub-Saharan Africa worst affected by the epidemic, too few individuals are able to reap the benefits of advances in treatment and prevention. In data from demographic and health survey studies, only one-fifth of adults reported having tested for HIV in the last 12 months, whilst just over half of women and one-third of men reported having ever tested. This testing gap is a major obstacle to improving our access to care and prevention. WHO recommends that all individuals attending health facilities in countries with generalised epidemics be offered provider-initiated testing and counselling. An acceptance of PITC is variable and very high among some groups, including hospitalised individuals and TB patients. Nevertheless, there's increasing recognition that provider-initiated HIV testing and counselling is necessary but not sufficient to interrupt the epidemic. In programmatic conditions, once the resources provided by research studies are removed, uptake of PITC can dramatically fall off. In Blantyre, we saw that 13% of facility attendees underwent PITC, with high rates amongst pregnant women but very low rates amongst men and non-pregnant women. Most community members do not attend health facilities, and qualitative work has shown that men in particular find clinics unwelcoming. Healthcare workers are extremely overburdened and are simply unable to offer PITC to all individuals attending clinics, but instead target testing to those who either request testing or those who have overt symptoms or signs of HIV. For facility attendees, the inconvenience of attending clinics, the long waits and the perceived lack of confidentiality and risk of stigma are barriers to completing HTC. Taken together, these factors mean that facility-based PITC offers an important role in diagnosis of HIV, but as currently implemented, will be insufficient to achieve the rates of HIV testing required. Community-based approaches to HTC are complementary to facility-based approaches, and recent evidence shows that they offer a potential to achieve high rates of uptake across a broad spectrum of the population. A recent systematic review and meta-analysis, six distinct models of community-based HTC were identified, including testing offered to household members of index cases, self-testing, mobile testing, door-to-door HIV testing, workplace testing, and school testing, with high acceptance rates seen in most of these approaches. Additional benefits include the high prevalence of first-time testers, diagnosis of HIV at statistically significant higher CD4 counts, and reasonable rates of linkage into care. However, it should be noted that the 73% of ART-eligible individuals who link into care is about the same rate that's seen in the systematic review of facility testers reported by Kranzer et al. And that still suggests that over a quarter of people are unable to access ART following community-based testing. Self-testing probably has gained the most press in the last year, with promising data from Malawi and Zambia and the FDA approval of OroQuick. To date, in a series of studies in Malawi and Zambia, nearly 20,000 self-tests have been performed as part of research projects. It's important to recognise that HIV self-testing can be implemented across a spectrum with greater or less supervision from health workers, and a number of these models are currently being investigated. In Blantyre, as part of a series of cluster randomised trials, HIV self-testing has been widely implemented at community level with distribution of OroQuick. All individuals who self-test can be referred or self-refer for facility-based care. And I'll just go on to present some of that initial data from the first year of availability of self-testing, where we've shown that 82% of all adult residents in study communities have requested a self-test kit, 89% have returned a used test kit, and 96% would recommend self-testing to families and friends. However, despite this, clear evidence also exists that community availability of self-testing alone is insufficient to impact upon population ART initiation. Population rates of ART initiation in communities where self-testing was available were similar to rates where no self-testing was available. In contrast, where self-testing individuals were offered home initiation of care, there was a threefold increase in ART initiation, with home initiations providing substantial additionality in numbers. Looking at HIV self-testing uptake by sex and age group, a number of key trends are apparent. This graph shows data for the first 6 months of testing availability, and firstly, overall uptake is high amongst both men and women. Secondly, substantial lower uptake is seen amongst older men. This is clearly a group where more work needs to be done. But reassuringly, we had very high uptake amongst young women who are a key target group. So just to summarise, HIV self-testing is a rapidly evolving field with a number of new trials either underway or funded. In August 2013, the first international symposium on self-testing was held, sponsored by the Broecher Foundation and hosted by WHO. And a number of important questions remain unanswered or incompletely answered. And I've listed some of these questions here. And I'd hope we can come back to discuss some of these questions in our panel discussion. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, great. So we'll keep those in mind and we'll come back to them. And it's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Rosanna Peeling, who's Professor and Chair of Diagnostics Research at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She spent 9 years at WHO working on systems for diagnostics and evaluation of diagnostics, and she'll be presenting very briefly on the next arm of Treatment 2.0 on using diagnostics and innovation. Thank you.
Thank you, Meg, and thank you to Godfrey and you and Marco for inviting me to give a snapshot of what we've been doing about getting these point-of-care diagnostics into use a lot quicker. So as if you've seen from Marco's summary, that there are a lot of point-of-care technologies that have been developed, and some are already on the market, such as the Alere Pima, and others, there are five other CD4s, that some of which are actually instrument-free, are almost ready to go into market. And similarly, for viral load, there are actually quite a lot of instruments, big and small, that would be ready for market. And so this is really exciting, very good news, but what's wrong with the picture? From our experience of watching companies introduce new technologies into countries, it has never been easy. The pipeline, even if you have a product that's ready today, you have to do all kinds of trials to show that your product is it's accurate, it's good, it's robust. And then companies do the trials in different hospital settings, field settings, and they submit the dossier to a regulatory agency or to WHO pre-qualification. But these regulatory agencies and WHO would say, oh, these are company-sponsored studies. They may be biased. We required independent studies. And so then another set of trials are done. So now there's a duplication of trials. And in fact, the first point-of-care CD4 that's been marketed by PIMA, the president of Lair told me that they've been doing 60 trials in different countries. 40 of them are in Africa, and they're still counting. And so granted, some of those are marketing studies and not about getting approval. Most of them are for getting approval. So in reality, how many trials do you need to show that the test works? And so what we're proposing to do is to try and reduce that time by having, instead of having two sets of trials, to collapse them into one. And so to try and reduce the time from 2 to 5 years to something like half the time that's required. And then we also realize that policy and implementation, countries actually need a lot of data on cost effectiveness, feasibility of introduction, et cetera, to actually make policy, and they need to think about the implications of scale-up, where do they get the finances, where do they put these instruments, et cetera. And so that's another 5 to 7 years. So the reality is, if we have a product that's ready today, it could be as much as 7 to 12 years before it's widely used in the field. And so what the funders have decided to do is to try and do something about that. And so we were very fortunate to be funded by Unitaid to actually try to lower barriers to market entry for companies by getting together all the global players to say, okay, what are the target product profiles for these tests? What are the product specifications we want in terms of stability, et cetera, and performance expectations and the methods of validation? And then what we want to do is to prepare a network of sites similar to the HIV vaccine trial sites, where we could get really good data, and then we will convene national regulatory authorities to jointly review single sets of data rather than for each country to demand a separate trial. And I would touch very briefly on what we're doing with regulatory authorities separately in the next slide. We're also working with countries to try and accelerate possibly the development of policy and adoption by actually asking questions like, in terms of investment into lab systems versus point of care, there's a lot of, sort of policy that still needs to be developed around how do you go about doing that in a more evidence-based way. So we're hoping to develop models of laboratory infrastructures and then where the patients are so that you have the models to actually look at different strategies for introduction of new technologies, whether they're point of care or instruments, and be able to know where you can maximize your investment. And so there's a lot of questions about these instruments allowed us to have data transmission, not only one way to a central database, but also two ways. How do we maximize that kind of capability to make health systems work better? And then the whole issue of sustainability. Everybody's very excited about new technologies, and donors will invest a lot of money into introduction. But what about in the long term? And countries need to think about that. And we also realize that as you introduce point-of-care instruments, instead of having quality control and quality assurance systems in the lab, doing that in the field is much more challenging. So with the introduction of each new technology, we're helping countries look at how to introduce quality assurance systems and also post-marketing surveillance. Now, in Africa, we've been working very hard at getting regulatory authorities in Africa to harmonize the way that they regulate in vitro diagnostics. And in the first year, we managed to get the five countries in the East African community to commit to harmonization. And in our second year, we actually managed to get more countries, 15 more countries committed. And so we've now formally formed a Pan-African Harmonization Working Party, and we are now set up within the African Union, and the agenda is first agenda is point of care technologies for CD4 viral load and early infant diagnosis. And we not only work in Africa, but we also work in Asia and Latin America for harmonization. Now, what we like to do is to have faster access to quality assured point of care diagnostics for CD4 viral load and early infant diagnosis. We hope that within the next 2 or 3 years, we'll see a considerable reduction in the number of trials that are needed and also a much more streamlined process for regulatory approval and policy development. And so these are our partners in this venture. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And we have one last presentation, and then we're going to try to leave at least 20 minutes for discussion, or 15 minutes. And we have Roger Tech from Doctors Without Borders, who's an HIV operational advisor for MSF working in Swaziland and Mozambique. And we know that MSF has been very integral in innovations. So we hope we can discuss rapidly what's new in service delivery so we leave adequate time for questions.
Okay, thanks, Meg. Well, thanks for inviting MSF to present here on our experience with service delivery models and then especially what we consider as important areas of innovation. We are a medical humanitarian organization. We are supporting HIV programs in, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in some countries in Asia. Just briefly to say what we see as priorities now for MSF as medical humanitarian organization is to support access to ARV treatment in low-coverage countries and also to respond to care and treatment gaps in the high-coverage countries. We are also involved in piloting early treatment initiation, so in line with the treatment as prevention strategies. And that's the main topic of this presentation, we are promoting community approaches and self-management. So to support that long-term treatment retention and treatment effectiveness. Well, delivery models, what works? I'm not going to enter in detail here, but what was presented already by Marco is the strategies which are working: integration, simplification, task shifting, involvement of lay people, decentralization. I would like to say something briefly about task shifting, where indeed all of us we have been working on task shifting with regard to counseling, testing, pre-ART, ART preparation adherence, and that is going in the direction, of course, of nurses, but then more and more to professional counselors, lay counselors and expert patients. The clinical care, however, that's task shifting from the medical doctors, the clinical staff, to the nurses. But what I would like to underline here is this whole task shifting strategy, which is successful in most of the contexts where we work, is that the position of the lay counselors and the expert patients or expert clients remains quite vulnerable. They are recognized and they are accepted to have their place in the service delivery, but when it comes to integrating them formally in the function grid of the Ministry of Health and then to plan them in the budgeting, very often that they're being they're being neglected. And it's a concern for us because we feel that in the current context of financial constraints that this cadre risks to be left out, and that's definitely going to be a weakness in the further development of service delivery. Well, current areas of innovation, what do we consider as important areas? Well, it was already presented by one of the previous speakers. Well, community-based HIV testing, definitely. Linkage and retention, and there are several strategies to work on that. Viral load treatment monitoring and community-based models. And I'm going to speak a little more about the last two because the previous two have been covered. The route access to viral load testing, and then especially we are pushing for routine viral load monitoring. It's important to realize that it's not only about detecting treatment failure. It's especially first and for all about detecting adherence problems, so that it can trigger targeted adherence support. It's about timely detection of treatment failure and taking decisions on treatment. But it's also it's especially for the patients an important motivation tool. So it's the message to get and to stay undetectable is a very powerful message to motivate people to be adherent, and that's something I would like to want to underline here. And then, of course, viral load monitoring is important for program monitoring, to evaluate the performance of programs. Now, next thing, and that's the main part of this brief presentation, community-based models for the sake of treatment support and self-management. We have documented it, and with the support of UNITAIDS, and so that came out as a report in the middle of last year. And we are updating it again by the end of this year for the conference, the ICASA conference in Cape Town. We are referring here to community-based models in several countries, and we speak about, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Why are we pushing for community-based models? Well, the patient perspective, of course, is the most important to make it more user-friendly, to help them, to facilitate them to adhere to their treatment. And there's, of course, also the health system perspective, to diminish the workload and especially to create capacity for the health staff to initiate new patients and then to manage the difficult ones, the patients who are late presenters, unstable, or who are at risk for failing treatment. So we have what we want to say is there's no one size fits all. We have several models here: health posts run by community health workers, reducing appointment frequency with support to patients and with support to patient self-management. We have community ART groups, we have community adherence clubs, we have the patient-managed ART distribution. So that are the models which have been described in this report, and on which we continue to work. The common elements of those models is, well, it focuses on stable patients. It's about ART delivery, and of course, and the health checks and the referral is based on self-management and peer support. We have, well, you see the table there. I think what is important is that we're using criteria, eligibility criteria, ranging from voluntary participation. It's up to now only for adults. It's about eligibility criteria according to CD4, where people are with the CD4. Clinical criteria, of course. And then, of course, the, well, how well are doing people with adherence. Some models have included also pregnant women. What I still want to say briefly, and then I go immediately to the conclusion, is that, well, we have up to now, we have good data. It seems that treatment retention seems to be working well, even very well. But we must, of course, recognize that we are speaking here about stable patients who have been entered in those models as of 6 months up to 12 months. So I think that's what I want to say. I think my time is up. So I think I prefer to leave it for discussion. Thanks.
Thank you very much. All right, so I think at this point we'd like to open it up for questions and answers. And if there are any questions, please bring yourself to the mic and address whichever speaker or whichever panelist. And I think we can answer directly unless we gather a number of questions. Go ahead, Carlos.
Thank you. So just to be provocative, I mean, why do we need CD4 counts? I mean, they have been a barrier to getting people into care. They have been a barrier to get people who want treatment because you don't have the CD4 count, and now you got to get the viral load, and now you got to get this. And so the CD4 count is an anomaly of the way we developed this. And I know of no other infectious disease in which we don't provide treatment for an actively replicating infection, virus, bacteria, whatever. We don't get blood cultures and say, well, you know, your white count is not high enough, so we're not going to give you antibiotics until your white count is over 30,000. So why don't we just ditch it and stop doing guidelines that move the line like this? We if we want to get to the goal line, we have to be innovative, and this is not innovative.
Does anybody want to address that?
I would just agree with you. In Blantyre, we noticed that the commonest reason for dropout between testing and treatment for patients was the inconvenience of going back and forth to a central hospital to get a CD4 count result done. Although I value point of care CD4 count testing, it's only for that 10% of people now who are not eligible. So, yeah, I think I can see us going that way very soon.
And I would have to say the WHO has just come out of last week a discussion about CD4 monitoring. When is it required, or when is CD4 actually needed? And I think, and we'll be coming out with a technical update by January 2014. And I think it's really about the discussion of, what is the balance between CD4 and viral load? Do we need CD4, or when is CD4 needed? And I think there's still a debate about, is it needed just at some point, not as a bottleneck to initiation, but at least at some point in time to get a sense of how sick somebody is, but not for monitoring. So I think that was the general consensus. But you'll see it in a document soon. So in the back, please.
Alan Whiteside, University of KwaZulu-Natal. Two comments. First of all, Peter, you have a serious denominator-numerator confusion in your presentation, in my opinion. I really don't think that you need, for example, you give a percentage of people who test, and I think that there are people who you wouldn't want to test. For example, someone who is HIV positive and knows they are HIV positive should not be going back for another HIV test. I'm flattered that you think that the over 50s are as sexually active that they need to test as regularly as they do, but I think they don't. And I think it's important to recognize that testing has a cost. It has a financial cost to the health system, and it also has a cost to people. So I really think you need to go back and look at your paper and understand denominators and numerators, because I don't think you do. The question that I would like to pose is to Roger, which is Swaziland. It's a country which is very dear to my heart. I think it's really important not to skip over the role of lay councillors, because we're putting so much burden on poor people across Africa. And I don't believe it's appropriate that we should have the poor people taking care of the destitute. So my question to you is, how are we going to operationalize rewarding these people who are so critical to our response in some way? Thank you.
So I'll offer to Peter first and then to Roger.
Thanks very much for the comment. With regards to the denominator, the denominator in this cluster randomized trial was all adult residents. We didn't do a population survey to determine everybody's HIV status and ART eligibility status at the baseline of the trial. That's why we used all adult residents as the denominator. And I think that's probably the appropriate denominator in this case. With regards to older men, there still is reasonable evidence of ongoing transmission amongst older men. I think there's additional benefits of offering, you know, whole community universal HIV testing as well, in that it has the potential to normalise HIV testing further, but also to link into other community health programmes such as mass drug administration, vaccination campaigns as well. So, I can see your argument, but I think there are also some potential benefits.
The question about the lay councillors. We believe that lay counsellors, all the people we use as lay counsellors, whether they are doing HIV testing and counselling, whether they organise treatment, education and adherence counselling, or whether they are linking up with community support groups, that those lay counsellors, those lay people, they need to be paid, they need to be remunerated. Because we ask them to make themselves available, and of course that has an opportunity cost for them. So that's what we stand for. We push for that. However, we have to be realistic. We cannot continue to increase the workforce for delivering HIV/AIDS services. When we speak about the community-based models, they should be rather patient-driven. And it makes sense. And we have also models like that in developed contexts, a world where patients take care of themselves, support each other, and are not being remunerated for that. It's in fact they are available for getting together when they are expected to come together to get their medicines and to get their checkups.
Thank you. So we'll go front, back, left, and back, front again.
I'd like to do a little riff on a previous question about CD4s. I think there are infections that are not treated. I can think of CMV and hepatitis C. Now, maybe they'll be treated in the future, but at the moment they're not. I think CD4 is important, at least at some point, because it tells us who needs prophylaxis for opportunistic infections and who don't. I agree completely that once their CD4 is above, pick a number, and their viral load is undetectable, again, pick a number, that you probably don't need to do CD4s. In Australia now, we're doing them once a year, but I think that's basically a ritual.
So we appreciate that, and that's sort of the general consensus that we're starting to get from our consultations. So in the back, Gital.
Thanks very much. My name is Gitao Mbro from the International HIV Alliance, based here in Brighton. I have a comment and a question. I mean, the comment that I would like to make relates to community health workers. And we've been, from our experience, seeing a very high turnover of community health workers because of precisely the questions that have been raised, concerns about remuneration, career path, professional development, and incorporation into the ministry structures. We've seen some good progress, I think, in Malawi and Ethiopia, but there's a lot more to be done in these countries, and I think we all need to speak together in terms of making sure that community workers, health workers, are recognized and remunerated. So that's a comment. My question really relates to operationalization of your work in relation to lay health workers and counselors. And particularly bearing in mind that WHO now has made a very concrete recommendation that community health workers are allowed to dispense ART. And in many, many different countries, especially where we work, for example, Cambodia, Eastern Europe, this is totally unheard of for community health workers to dispense ART. So we congratulate WHO for making that bold step. But I think what we'd like to hear from you, Roger, especially, is whether you've had to deal with any policy impediments, and whether you've had to get some kind of policy agreement with government in those countries where you work, which allows community health workers to do the kind of work that you're asking them to do, and whether, in your view, part of the work that we need to do now to implement the new guidelines around community health workers being able to dispense ART requires a lot more work around that area. And maybe bearing also in mind that this could be more of a problem in Eastern Europe, as I mentioned, and also in Asia, where those countries have not really moved forward in incorporating community health workers as service providers as maybe sub-Saharan African countries have done. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Well, I can only say that I'm agreeing with what has been said. It's, as I said in the presentation, very often there's a framework for task shifting, but not, it doesn't go further than that. And in fact, community health workers or lay counselors, whatever we call them, very often they are there because they are supported by NGOs, but not yet by the ministries of health.
Okay.
A question for Marco Vittoria. I know that the WHO took 4 years to move from 200 to 350, and then 3 years from 350 to 500 this year. So, and we congratulate the WHO heavily because of doing that. But when is the next step coming? Or what are the barriers in order to move to, irrespective of CD4 cell cancer, start offering treatment to all? Do you think the main obstacle is an economic one? Because it looks like a medical one is not an obstacle. But most of the countries, they're still waiting for WHO movement in order to for them to move. So if WHO doesn't do that step, most of the countries, they won't move.
Well, regarding the issue of the guidelines, you know, WHO have a very, let's see, very comprehensive approach in terms of revise the norms, because it's a global norm that should consider a lot of aspects. But, for example, to revise a document like this is more than 1 year in order from all steps involved in terms of establish the proper set of questions, go to systematic reviews, check the other components in terms of feasibility, acceptability, some cost effectiveness, and as all these pieces are putting together. And for this process in 2013, and I think Meg can coordinate the process, can even complement that, when they discussed about going beyond 500, in fact, this discussion was there, basically, and then you check, consider the methodology for evidence check adopted by WHO in many organizations, that is a great system, and then you see where you can go in terms of this. And for beyond 500, basically, is to recommend to all, the evidence around this is still not very clear. And also the other components about how to do it is also missing. That's why now we need to see how these projects, these protocols that's been running now in different places like Brazil, Rwanda, Indonesia, in specific situations, can help us to move ahead and also see how the other issues around the evidence you move in terms of new studies and also results of the current ones that's still ongoing. But basically, they consider the quart of the evidence, the body of evidence that exists, and also the other components in terms of feasibility and acceptability in different contexts, make this discussion a little more difficult going beyond 500. But definitely, it's already a clear trend in discussions in WHO in how to address this. And irrespective of the CD4, what are the other components needed in order to increase access to treatment independent of that? But basically, the issues around evidence check is basically considering all these issues around the evidence that exists today and how this evidence can be put in a way that can fit a global framework in all situations. Then, and I think that the what you have today is really what the evidence shows us, consider all elements, balancing evidence, programmatic and operational, but clearly moving ahead the agenda on this, that I believe that the next guideline, certainly you address it a little better. Let's see how these components you go.
Yeah, just carrying on the guidelines. Hi, Marco. Obviously, we talked about a lot of recommendations in there that there are in there, increasing testing, supporting adherence, getting people off stavudine, introducing viral load monitoring, getting people who have got CD4 350 to 500 on treatment. So the thing that I kind of put myself in the shoes of someone like the health minister from Malawi, who was here on Sunday. How do we kind of fill the gap of actually who's going to tell them which of those to do first? Mm-hmm. What are the priorities within a given country? And I know that the guidelines went some way to try to do that this time, to try and be practical about. But I still see it missing. I wouldn't know what to do without spending about a year doing some complicated modelling. So I really just don't know who, you know, so I feel like there's a gap there, and I'd like people's kind of views about how we feel that for individual countries. We've got individual country models like the spectrum model, which is, you know, really helpful, but it isn't going to answer all those questions.
Yeah, in fact, we have 40 recommendations, the guidelines.
40, right, okay.
The total. Basically, if you go and get to check all that have been rated there. Then you have a specific chapter in the guideline that discuss about the programmatic and operational right. issues. But basically, they give some guidance. But in practice, countries should have this process discussed internally according to their present values and also what are the, their own views on that. That's why the WHO guidelines give a kind of, okay, this is what has been identified as really what to do, but recognizing clearly that the decision about what is the prioritization, the programmatic aspect is, what should come first, it depends a lot of the, number one, of the profile of the epidemic, definitely yes, in terms of concentrated, generalized or coverage, whatever, they use some of these parameters in the guidelines, the discussion there. You give some basic, some tips or some perspectives, but the fine-tuning of this specific issue should be done based in the support
those,
of the implementation.
Those are some of the most difficult questions, right?
Yeah.
It's the
is
prioritization ones. I just think we should help a bit more.
So, yeah,
but I haven't got a clear plan for how to do it.
Well, I can tell you some things that we're doing at WHO. We have done already, we're going to every region and we're doing dissemination workshops, and we've already done five or so of them, and we'll continue to do them. And we bring the countries together, and we've had two in had one in Afro, and we'll have two, and by the end, this is done. And we've also been doing some country consultations. And during this time, we really look at what are the current priorities for the country, what are their current policies, what are the ones that they're already implementing well, or not implementing well. And then the countries have been coming already with their partners, as well as the Ministry of Health, and have had some discussions about it prior to coming to the workshops, and they themselves have prioritized what they feel they can get done. And certainly those countries that are looking at financing or self-financing their entire ARV program have a different perspective than those that are still very donor-supported. And I would have to say that most have not felt challenged to expand ART to a higher CD4 count, but when you get or to adopt a new single-dose, fixed-dose combination. Where there's some challenges might be along what do we do for children, how do we reach children, how do we do viral load? That seems to be a challenge for some countries. And I would have to say that the spectrum models and using what the countries already have in terms of the goals and aims have been very helpful for costing. And then countries have also been working with other partners, UNAIDS, CHAI, et cetera, to do even more in-depth cost analysis, look to see cost-benefit of various approaches. And lastly, there is the One Health tool. I haven't yet seen a country using this where they can actually look at opportunity costs to their entire health system. And certainly PEPFAR countries have their costing tools as well. And so I think with all of that, that helps ministries of health and their partners come to the table and make some educated guesses and educated decisions, not necessarily guesses, about what to do first. And then to sit back in a year's time and take a look at this. And most countries realize this is a process. It will take 6-12 months to really put this into, and there's some things they can do quite easily, those that they can't do so easily. And they're very good at prioritizing, I get the sense already. So I would go and talk to some ministers and some health and HIV program managers, because they really have already figured out some of this already. Mm-hmm. But I think that being said, if there's no more questions, thank you very much for some great questions, and we'd be happy to answer others in detail should you need more, and we'll let you go on to the next session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ask you the presentation by mail. Like, okay.